We'd like to get started with our LegalZoom Sundance TV panel. I'm so excited to be back, so thank you, LegalZoom and Sundance TV, for having me back this year. My name is Madhu, and I'm a lawyer for Sundance TV and AMC Television Networks. I've been practicing for about 15 years, and although my life is completely in television right now, and I love it, I've had a lot of time working on documentaries and independent films. I was at A&E prior to AMC. I worked on their documentary films, many of which were here, premiered at Sundance. And a long time ago, as a young associate, I was at a law firm and worked on a lot of production issues with documentaries and independent film. But I think more than that, I just love the medium. There's stories that can be told in documentaries that sometimes start movements, sometimes end atrocities that are happening to the environment, to animals, to humans alike. And sometimes documentaries just leave you feeling good. What's most exciting today is that we've got a wonderful panel of directors who have dealt in each of these areas, and I think you are going to really enjoy learning more about their films and learning about some of the legal complexities that came about in making these films. So I'd like to introduce and welcome my fellow panelists. So because I could spend an hour, I think, talking about each and every single one of our panelists up here, I feel like I'm not going to be able to do justice to their background. So I'm going to ask each of them to introduce themselves, talk a little bit about why they're here, tell us a little bit about their film and their role in bringing it to fruition.
So we'll start with the guy without the film. So I'm the token attorney, not the bad kind of attorney, but hopefully the good kind of attorney. And I think everybody today will kind of talk about when you need an attorney. And I'm more of a foil to kind of back that up or support them and engage in dialogue. So thank you for having me back again this year, and I'll pass it on to you.
I'm Laura Dunn, and director, producer, editor of Look and See, A Portrait of Wendell Berry. For those of you who don't know, Wendell Berry is a farmer and a writer in Henry County, Kentucky. I think he's one of our greatest living writers today. And so the purpose of the documentary is just to introduce him to people and to draw him to light.
So I'm Sten Johansen, and I'm the editor and co-director of Last Man in Aleppo. And I'm come out of Copenhagen, where I worked as an editor for many, many years. And this is my first time directing together with Firas.
I'm Firas Fayyad. I'm a Syrian filmmaker. I'm director of Last Man in Aleppo. I'm coming from Copenhagen. I live in officially in Germany, work in Copenhagen, forced to leave my country.
My name is Austin Peters, and I am the director of Give Me Future, which is the story of the Major Lazer concert that happened in Havana, Cuba. And the film tracks several different young people who live in Havana right now and sort of highlights how they're able to create their own world through sort of DIY and building their own sort of community of electronic music and technology and art in a situation where there's not a lot of opportunities for them to do so.
My name is Ramona Diaz. I am the director of Motherland. The film is about the busiest maternity hospital in the world, which happens to be in Manila, Philippines. So the film takes place completely in the hospital. And it's a purely observational verite film, and truly observational.
Thank you. I think you'll notice that we've got a lot of directors here who decided to tell their stories on a global landscape, except for Laura, whose film is very much tied to the American landscape. But I think the similarity that you see is that there is a strong connection between the protagonists or the subject matter that you guys explore and the environment that they find themselves in. And sometimes that environment has a political backdrop that they explore very subtly and at other times pretty head on. I think that you're going to find that more than these similarities, there's probably some similarities in the legal complications that they faced as well. So getting right into our discussion, Tom, you know, you're a lawyer, and you've actually spent a lot of time working on legal issues for your clients, both on the transactional side as well as the litigation side. In your experience, what can filmmakers do ahead of time that might save them thousands of dollars after the fact if they didn't pay attention to the right things?
So it's a little self-serving, right? But I think the number one thing you can do as a small filmmaker, big filmmakers already know this, is find a lawyer that you trust and start working with them from day one. If you don't do that, you're going to, if your movie never makes any money, you're fine, because nobody's ever going to care. But if your movie does well, which is the goal, I think, for everybody on stage, then it's going to be a whole hellstorm if you haven't found a good lawyer and you don't have clearances, you don't have an agreement with your investors, you don't have the right contracts with your contractors, you haven't bought the script. I mean, movies have been made where scripts weren't owned, and I don't know if you can imagine how much money that makes a law firm after the fact. It's fantastic. But I think the best thing you can do is find a lawyer early on, and one that you trust and can work with.
So for our directors up here, would you say that you bring on legal counsel right at the inception of the process?
Yeah, I do. I learned, you know, from my first film that it's the price of doing business. You have to have a lawyer at the very beginning. I mean, just to give you advice, you may take or leave it, right? But you know what the legal landscape is. And I usually have my release forms vetted first. When it's signed, that's a whole different, that's a whole different question, right? But you should get advice very early on so you know what you're up against.
Yeah, I agree with her. I start without a lawyer, and later I feel like it's important to have somebody to advise you and tell you should be like this, and if you fall in this is mistakes, then it will effective in you in later in the film. I mean, in the process of making the film, in the professional as a filmmaker. And also with the deal with the characters. If you want to show this character in the film, then you want to have some deals with them. You should be very careful with the word that you will use, with the way that you will use them in your film. And for me, from my experience, yes, I know all of these things with the dealing with the characters. But for my career, I was like nothing. I have no idea about what's my right and what the producer right. Then I fall with many mistakes before, and I lose many films because I have no idea. In the film school, we learn how we do movies, but we didn't learn what's make the movies sometimes, what they make the director to create it as a director.
That's really interesting. Can you think of anything particular with respect to your current film in which, you know, you had that aha moment that, oh, okay, I need legal counsel?
And this is film or film before?
Well, either way.
Actually, a lot of things. I mean, in general, you feel like if you, especially in my situation, I'm forced to leave my country, and then I should to start my career in different country, and a lot of things I don't know. I have no idea about how they work in Denmark or in Germany or on there. Then I have to know how the contract and deal and all of these things, because in my country, I'm somebody knows. Like between the people, so the things it's coming like normally, and there's a lot of misunderstood about the career and the work in the career that's happened, and that's make me sometimes lose my something in my work before in one of my films that I do before. I don't want to go in the details because I fight a lot. Against to that with a new environment and new life and to do my career.
Laura, I think you wanted to jump in there.
Well, it's kind of what we were talking about before. I think I'm a little, I'm willing to take risks. I think sometimes that, we were talking about this, but I think sometimes in documentary film, It would be nice if you had all your release forms and you had all your location releases and you had kind of everything lined up before you shot and you edited, but that just doesn't always happen. And we were talking about an example. I think it's helpful to get legal counsel, certainly, but I don't always abide by it, I guess is what I want to say. Because
which is very common with every single independent film company I've ever worked with. So, yeah.
I mean, it's good to know what you're up against, like Cremona said, but I also think sometimes you make those calculated risks. And we were talking about an example. So I had a film here 10 years ago called The Unforeseen, and I had this interview with a lobbyist. It's about development and kind of the water wars in Austin, Texas, and there was a lobbyist who was one of the most powerful lobbyists in the state of Texas. A lot of people said he was sort of the puppet master behind all of these laws that were dismantling the environmental laws in the state of Texas and enabling a lot of destruction of natural resources. And anyway, I convinced him to do an interview with me. And he wouldn't let me film his face, but he let me film his hands. And so the whole construction is he's building this model warplane as he's telling you about how he destroyed and dismantled all of the environmental laws in the state of Texas. Wow. And it's fantastic, right? But he would not sign a release form. So the film was accepted into Sundance. We had locked picture. I had investors for that film, which is something I would never do again probably. But and we were set to premiere at Sundance, and he still hadn't signed a release form. So it was one of those moments when it's like, well, do we go for it or not? Fortunately for me, I sent him a copy of the movie, I sent him a release form, and I got a letter back, and he had signed it, and he had a little smiley face sticker on it, and it said, good work, with an exclamation mark. So I think he liked himself portrayed as sort of the Darth Vader. So I was fortunate that he liked the reflection of him as this powerful dismantler. But I'm just giving you that as an example where I think it's really good to know what you're up against, but I also think sometimes you have to roll the dice and take a risk, and you might be right, you might be wrong, but it's part of the process.
But on the other hand, you know, they can't sign all the releases that you want them to sign, but if, at the end of the day, if they want to sue you, they will sue you. Right? Because I was sued by my very first subject. I was here with the film Imelda, I think 10 years ago, too. And she had signed off. She saw the film before the Sundance premiere. She had a few problems. Imelda Marcos is a former First Lady of the Philippines. She had a few problems with the film, and I told her, it's locked, it's done. And she goes, okay, we're fine. And she was fine until 6 months later, we were released theatrically, and the reviews came in, and then suddenly she saw herself through the eyes of the reviewers, and they called her a pariah and all that, and she wasn't happy. And then she sued, you know. So even if we had all our paperwork in place, she still sued us.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Tom.
Well, no, I was just going to say that lawsuit was much less expensive if she signed a release. If she hadn't, you would have been toast.
But you still had to go, you know. Oh, yeah. Had to go through.
I can sue you if I don't like your hair. We kind of talked about it. It doesn't mean you'll win, but the releases are, at the end of the day, the thing that lets you do what you do and get paid for doing what you do, right, as well.
So. No, that's a fair point. And, you know, it's interesting because even when you have months to prepare and you feel like you have all your ducks in a row, it may not turn out exactly the way you want. Austin, I think, you know, we have, like, a very different sort of story with you. With your film that you directed that took place in Cuba, I believe that you had 3 weeks between when it was approved and when you found yourself on the ground. So if you could tell us a little bit about that process and sort of what kind of legal challenges that posed.
Yeah, well, we got approval to shoot this concert by the Cuban government probably 3 weeks before the event. So we threw this team together of great people who came together, and we went down to Cuba, and we sort of were writing and scouting and casting and shooting all simultaneously. And there's sort of a, you know, I had never been to Cuba before, but you need to, lots of things are against the rules. And you sort of learned that very quickly, in that all of our producers down there were all Cuban, and there were certain places that we weren't allowed to shoot, there were certain people we weren't allowed to talk to, and all of this was, you know, made very clear to us very early that if we were, you know, wanted to shoot on this street, we had to do it very sneakily because, you know, the government officials would drive down there every day. Or if we wanted to talk to an activist, that would basically be the end of our film, that we would be tailed for the rest of the time we were there, and we would probably be thrown out because that's just how it works. But yeah, there was kind of a learning curve in figuring out how that all works, even down to the concert when you know, the group wanted to bring out a friend of theirs who was in town from Jamaica, and they, you know, didn't clear that with the government as they had cleared the concert. And she came out, and it became a huge ordeal. Who is this person? What is she doing here? Her visa is not an artist visa. How is she on stage? And they had another friend who's the biggest rapper in Cuba, huge, huge star. We would go places with him, and cabbies would take pictures with him, and everyone wanted to talk to him. He's a huge star. And they wanted to bring him out, and we were planning on it. And it was going to be this great moment where he came out and performed this song, and everyone would have gone completely insane. It would be like bringing out Jay-Z or something. You know, it would be so, so massive. And right before he was going to go on, the government stepped in and said, you are not to go on stage. And he didn't. And I think that that was very telling, that he didn't go on stage, that he took what... He grew up in this country, and he took it quite seriously that they didn't want him on stage. So we sort of just had to adapt and, you know, try and tell that story in a different way.
Out of curiosity, did the officials that you were working with in the Cuban government, did they ask for editorial review of the film?
No, they wouldn't. We didn't have any sort of interaction with them. We wanted to interview some of them, and they wouldn't talk to us, really. It was sort of like we had just been permitted to shoot this film or shoot whatever it was we were shooting, but we weren't. We were kept definitely at arm's length from them at all times. And I think that, you know, the production company that we were working with all Cuban producers, they obviously have a relationship with the government. That's why they're able to do what they do, and that's why they're able to do. They have more access to the internet than a normal citizen does, and they have more access to things that allows them to, you know, help us shoot this film. So they were sort of our filter throughout the whole time. If something was not okay, they would flag it pretty immediately. And of course, they were our collaborators, and this is their film too, and we wanted to do right by them, and they live there. So, you know, we tried to be respectful of that.
Wow. Ramona, I know that when we were talking in the back, you were saying that the film that you made, Motherland, was in some ways the easiest film that you've made from a legal perspective. Can you talk a little bit about that in comparison to your other films where you had some legal issues you were dealing with?
Yeah, it just seemed easier. I mean, to get access to the hospital in the Philippines, I went directly to the Secretary of Health because I needed carte blanche access to every part of the hospital and to be there for a month, really, and for many hours of the day. We were there, it was like 16-hour days. And he signed off, and pretty much we were there and filming everything. I mean, if you see the film, we film births, we film everything in the hospital. And yeah, it turned out to be easier than some of the films I've made. You know, some of the films I've made have been with like rock stars who wouldn't sign until the very end, and it's a handshake deal, and you're like, ugh, okay, you know, let's hope that it really, you know, that they sign. And they, you know, everything, they did sign, and then we won the lawsuit with Imelda Marcos, so all those. So this one, it like pales in comparison compared to like rock stars and first ladies. And the truth of the matter is, you know, I filmed very impoverished women. So it's a whole other ethical problem, right? Because you're asking them to sign a release form, which they do, but should you be asking them to sign it in the first place? Should you be in the hospital filming them? So that's a whole other ethical problem. It's a whole other question in a way, because they did sign it. I mean, some of them, they came in labor, and we wanted to film them, and we would film them. Then after the labor, after they'd been, like, they've delivered their babies, I'd go to them and say, we filmed you in labor delivering your baby. This is the film I'm making. Do you want to sign on? And some of them said no, in which case we didn't even transfer the footage, you know, because I didn't want to be confused, you know, people who said women who said yes, and women who said no. And some of them said, yes, yeah, it's fine. I said, do you understand what that means? We're going to be following you in the hospital. And for the most part, I took their word for it that they understood, you know, but we were there for a month. Some of them, you know, later, like 2 weeks later, were like, no, we really don't want to be part of it. And that's fine, too. You know, it's documentary filmmaking.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that you say how easy it was to get access to the hospital in the Philippines. But, for example, if you were making that film in the United States, with all of our privacy laws and HIPAA laws, I mean, it would be almost impossible to get that type of film made. So, in some instances, I guess, when you're filming outside the U.S., you might find some access easier.
Right.
And in other instances, there's other considerations, I think, that pose greater problems. for us, maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, your environment in Syria. I mean, obviously, your film takes place in sort of the epicenter of one of the most contentious political debates that have been taking over the country. And I'm sure that you dealt with some issues to the extent that you can share with the audience. We'd love to hear about them.
Yeah. Just to think that you want to film in Syria, it's a big issue. Because it's a start like many obstacles in front of you and in front of you in your head. And like when we start like choosing the subject, White Helmets, to be like the subject of our films, there is many media was interesting to do this is film, and a lot of list that waiting to do this is film, and they have powerful, and they use their relation with the function and the people that they know to get that. For me, I'm coming from the local environment and start like to have this is communication about what's important to tell and why we should share the stories. And this is the way that I start to have the connection with the character. One of the things that make the character agree and what the thing that the character was in position don't agree about that, it's like they don't want to show their film, their self. They don't like the show off in front of the camera and filming their work because they believe this work should be like for the good and not for the public. And from this point, I start to talk to them about how we can explain for the world how much your work is important, how much this is more effective in your life, how much it's important to follow you and tell your story behind every rescue mission that you run through it, because it's like a marathon. Like when the bomb, like when the barrel bomb, I'm talking about like 250,000 TNT inside the barrel through from the sky up of the civilians area, and this is people running to there, and our mission was like how we can catch them there and how they agree to catch them there, because there is a woman and children and limbs with this as a victim. Also, like this is dealing with the people who is like the victim of inside your frame. With a long conversation about important sharing the story and establishment the trust, we reach like this is point. Trust, from the point of the trust and from the point of the trust of the people that they watch the movie. I told them there's the good things that the people who will watch the movie, they will do movement, they will do act to help you, to help to stop this war. Because the goal was how a documentary film can stop the war, horrible war, can change the world, can change the mind. For me as a filmmaker, Steen know that I don't have any hope. I told him I don't have any hope. The lowly hope that I have it, that how I can help the family of the character. But my conversation with the character was about how we can establish the trust and share your story because we want to stop the war. This is what the start point, and this is the same with also the people that including in the film, which is like one of the most effective scene, and it's like hurt me a lot, and I still like the process in my mind till now. Not easy to recover from this feeling.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. I mean, according to NPR, the White Helmets have saved over 40,000 lives. I mean, if you think about that number, it's sort of mind blowing. So incredible work, Laura. I want to explore, you know, your film a little bit and the process, the filmmaking process. I mean, can you think of a story that you can share with us where things didn't go totally as expected and you had to come up with a creative solution to solve a legal problem?
Well, yeah, I mean, the entire endeavor was that, because I wanted to make a portrait of Wendell Berry and Wendell Berry didn't want to be filmed, so it's a bit of a constraint. So I think the entire process was how do you make a portrait of this person? How do you reflect his essence? And without intruding on his privacy, like you talk about trust, I think we all know that. It's like the fundamental relationship you have with your subject is what the film is all built on. And so Wendell Berry is 82 years old. He's written more than 50 books. He's won every award you can imagine. And he lives in a rural Henry County, Kentucky. He's very protective of his privacy. And hundreds of people have asked to make films of him. He said no every time. So I think that my avenue with him was a careful one. A lot of letter writing back and forth. I think, you know, legally, it's not really an issue as much as it is just the trust, you know, that once they allow you into their world. And it was really through his wife that I was able to build that trust. And I said to him at the beginning, I'm not going to film you. I respect your constraint. I'm not going to try to trick you. I respect that. That's information about you. I'm going to work with that. And so we did. So I always said it's a film about the way Wendell sees the world. It's kind of a portrait of his mind's eye. It's what he sees, what he writes, what he cares about. That's what the material of the film is. And then his voice carries you through that place. I think that, you know, it's a far cry from Syria or the Philippines or these places or Cuba. Where there's such, you know, painful and visceral human rights issues happening. But I'm drawn to the rural landscapes in America, and I think the recent election illuminated for us why there is a disenfranchisement there. There is there's a quieter ideological struggle that's going on there where people are losing farms and land that had been in their families for hundreds of years, and there's an economy that's in decay. And I think sometimes in the documentary film world, we don't really want to look right at home. We want to look at the wrong things happening in other places when there's places right under our eyes that are deteriorating and in great struggle that, as we now see, have great political implications for all of us. So it's a quieter and more subtle struggle than I think some of these amazing filmmakers have tackled.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up to the panelists to share with us a story that maybe we haven't touched upon either from the current film that you worked on or from past films that you've been involved with.
I think something that everyone has kind of touched upon and is really helpful in terms of releases and getting the legal work all straightened away to have people to agree to be in the film and put themselves out there and reveal, you know, information about themselves and maybe things that they do that, you know, are maybe, you know, looked down upon in other parts of the world or in certain courts of law. I think that something that I'm hearing from everyone and something that was definitely part of our process is that it's about being upfront with people and it's about telling them what kind of film you're trying to make and what sort of, you know, what their participation can mean in the scope of your film and what that can add up to. And I found that in our experience, you know, some of our characters, the guy who runs the Paquete, Danny, which is the hand-to-hand underground sort of piracy network that supplies Cuba with all of its media, basically, you know, he had to come and suss us out and figure out what we were about.
How did you find him? How did you find him and get him to agree to be a part of the film?
We were introduced to him through a journalist who had done a piece on him at Vox called Johnny Harris, who is in our film. And Johnny put us in contact with Danny, and then Danny had to come to our hotel and or our production office, rather, and talk to us about, you know, what we were trying to do and sort of decide whether or not he was interested in participating in our film and if that seemed like a good idea for him. And I think that when we were able to be clear about what we were trying to do and that we were trying to make a movie about what it's like to be young in Cuba right now and separate of the politics and separate of the things that we so often see representing Cuba in films or television or travel magazines, and we wanted to make something that was more about being young and what it really meant to live there in this time, I think that he responded to that. And I think that in a country where there's such limited internet penetration and it's so hard to be in conversation with the rest of the world, I think it was exciting to a lot of the kids to be able to say something that other people would hear outside of Cuba, because it feels like you're trapped in an echo chamber, I think, in a lot of ways there. And it's hard to, like, you know, get your words and get your feelings out to anyone outside of this little island. And I think that was something that people really wanted to do when we gave them the platform to do that.
Amazing.
No, just a thought. Did I think reality television has made I'll speak just for myself, my work harder, or maybe our work harder. Because you really have to distinguish yourself from reality television, right? When you're talking to the people you want to film. Because you have to tell them it's not about the gotcha moment. We're not here to catch you acting badly, right? It's more a nuanced portrait or character than that. So I think, and it's all very performative because that's what, you know, they see. It's reality television. So it's really, for me, it's really important to tell the people who participate in my film that it's not about that. It's about me being there, immersed in their lives, and it's not about performance, and it's about getting to something more nuanced and more gray than black and white, you know, or acting badly.
Tom.
Well, so not following up on that point, but something someone said earlier about not wanting an investor, was that?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll just say this. So a lawyer could probably help you with that. That's something we run into with a lot of filmmakers, where you as an independent filmmaker will make your film and you'll form your LLC and you'll do the right things, but you'll have all your money and all your production in one LLC. But a lawyer might say, well, why don't you have your investors in a different LLC and you retain artistic control? It's a fantastic way to get money. But so there are things, I'm just kind of drawing it back to kind of that central idea, how do we help you guys who are independent filmmakers think about stuff, but you know, finding somebody from the get-go, but strategies like that. So you're presented with a challenge, you hate investors, right? Or
no.
Dislike investors.
No.
Don't appreciate investors' artistic
love
input,
investors.
Whatever it is. Yeah, but something about investors isn't always right with you making the film, and the right counsel, whether it's maybe another filmmaker who's had an experience, but also with some documents to go with it from a lawyer can fix that.
I think the struggle I'm talking about is not to be anti-investor. We love investors, right? But it's just that I think there's, and especially if you have the good fortune of being at a place like Sundance where there's a market for the work you've done, and theoretically you want the film and the message to get to as many people as possible, so those sales agents and those buyers are your friends and your allies, and I get all that. But I think my first film, I had investors, and I was looking at all of that, and I think for me, I ended up getting distracted by the idea that I made the film with money, and we needed to then make money with the film. And I think for me, I did it differently this time. And what I did is I used a fiscal sponsor, the Austin Film Society. Cheers for the Austin Film Society. And I had it all as a nonprofit structure, as a nonprofit. And so all grants, I worked with all grants, so all donations, everything was a tax-exempt donation. It was made through their fiscal sponsor, and they take a percentage, and then you yourself retain all the ownership. But it wasn't so much about ownership and money. It was so that I could always feel as a filmmaker, and this is how I want to always make films from now on, that the reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing are pure and the intentions are real. And if the film makes money, then those resources can pay my salary and can pay us fair wages for our hard work. But then those resources go back into the place that the film was about. So that's kind of what I was getting at. I think one other legal thing that I learned from last time around is that I made this film and thought, oh, we're going to play at Sundance, and then we're going to get a buyer, and then they'll pay all the music rights, and they'll pay the archival rights, and I don't have to worry about that. And I think that's something that green filmmaker learns, and that I'm also the editor, and it's really easy to get attached to a beautiful piece of music that's made by a kind of, you know, obscure European composer that you think, for sure, I can get this for $500. And they come back, and just for US TV rights, it's $25,000, you know? And that's a really careful thing to think about, and I'm working with an original composer. And I think archival rights is a big issue. I tend to use tons of archival from lots of different sources, and you might think that, you know, some Australian, you know, version of Frontline is going to give you this 3-second clip. No way, you know, they might want $10,000. And so I think what I learned is that I cleared all of my rights, world in perpetuity, raised the money to pay those before we played at Sundance. And I have almost every song is original, you know. And so those are the kinds of things I think you learn that if you sell your film, you have the good fortune to sell it, you know, it's you need to have all that in line before that moment if you want to be able to maybe use some of those resources to make another film or pay your deferred wages or, you know, all that the finances around documentary are.
So that's the unique thing, right? So now you're not just a filmmaker, you're a business person.
Sure.
And a lot of what's the left brain, right thing, I don't know if that's been debunked, but a lot of filmmakers are sort of left brain and focused so much on the art
yes.
that the business side of it kind of gets let go. So that's maybe another reason to have more than just artists involved initially.
Sure.
But I think Laura makes a great point, is that, you know, when you get to the point where a distributor is interested and ready to acquire your film, they have a whole host of things that they need. I mean, everything from music clearances to location releases, appearance releases, chain of title, title clearances. I mean,
you know, insurance, right?
That's so correct. That's, yeah.
Yeah, but it's a whole set of deliverables when you sign that distribution contract that costs money, and that's on you, and that's something you haven't budgeted for. You're so excited, someone is picking up your film and they send you the contract, and it's like 10 pages of deliverables, you know, that you never expected. Yeah, that was the first fail. So you have to get ready for those things.
And most of those, I mean, most of those 10 pages of deliverables are exactly what a production lawyer would be concentrating on during pre-production, production, and post, is getting you those materials so you could check them off the list. I mean, Tom, I'm sure you've got some interesting stories of advising clients to come up with creative solutions when they don't necessarily have everything checked off the list.
Well, so all my creative stories ended up costing the client a lot more money. So I think that the key point is that the earlier you do that, even if you do it kind of in the beginning of the creative process, it's going to cost you a heck of a lot less than if you're getting a contract and you're having to go through and clear those things post hoc, right, after the fact. So there was the film The Hurt Locker, right? And I went to deal with a legal issue on it, and I asked Daniel for the copyright registration on the film. And this is after it had won that kind of good award. And he kept sending me the application for the copyright by fax over and over. This is like a few years ago. We used fax machines a little bit. Over and over and over again. And I said, this isn't the registration. He's French. He kept saying, yes, it is. And so there was no copyright registration filed and issued on The Hurt Locker when it won the Academy Award, right? You would think that, like, that's something you would pick up on early, but it didn't happen. So I think that nobody's immune from this, and that was an independent studio, but nobody's immune from doing this. So the earlier you have your lawyer who's dialed into those kinds of things involved, the less expensive it is, which is huge for independent film budgets, mm-hmm. I think, right?
Yeah. And you know, we've talked a little bit about this too, is that when you're dealing with a tight budget, you often have to make decisions. You know, you can't go for that song that you want that costs $25,000 mm-hmm. for U.S. rights only. And you talked a little bit, Laura, about having an originally composed song where you own the rights and you don't have to worry about it. I mean, what other solutions have our directors and our filmmakers come up with that solve for some of these clearance problems?
Well, it also, I mean, fair use. You know, we have to also talk about fair use. And sometimes it depends on when the song comes into your film, you know, a little bit of tweaking and suddenly it's fair use. And you won't know that until a lawyer looks at your film and say, if you move it a little, then it's fair use. Or if you use it after, then it's fair use. You don't know that until a lawyer really watches and reviews your film. And it's amazing how much, you know, you can get away with fair use, tweaking things.
Remember,
right? Or,
well, so true,
right?
But it's a defense to infringement.
I know it is.
So you're infringing,
but
you're saying, well, but I've got a defense. I mean, yeah, absolutely. You can use things, and there's fair use doctrine, and it's fantastic. But it's also sort of subjective. No lawyer ever, I think, can probably say, this is 100% fair use.
No, yeah, it's not
black
and white.
So it's, you know, just it's certainly a good doctrine for documentary filmmakers.
Right, but
right?
If a lawyer is willing to write an opinion, right, based on that, then you can get your errors and omission insurance, and that's really what it's for, what it's about, right, to get
just
that
warning,
insurance.
Like, blanket fair use is like, well, it seems
blanket. I'm not saying blanket, but that's why it's important for a lawyer to look at your piece to see what's fair use or what could possibly be fair use if only you tweak your film a little bit.
Sure.
I also think that music itself poses its own unique set of problems. Austin, you could probably talk to this a little bit with your film.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, so we went down to Cuba to make a concert film about a DJ group, and they play songs that they wrote themselves, and they play a lot of songs by a lot of other people. And they play songs that they decide to play right then and there. So we kind of just shot and had to figure out afterwards, what can we use, what can we not use? And then there becomes an issue also with these songs where they're made from so many different pieces, and they're made from so many different collaborators, and we have to go down the laundry list of people, you know, who were involved to get them to clear it and get them to agree to have it be in our film. And I think that something that's helped us a lot and probably is helpful to all of us, especially with documentaries, is that when you can get to the artists directly and you can talk to them about, you know, what, and you can show them the film and you can see what they think about it and you can show them what it's about and how the song is used and what the song means in the film, they're much more willing to play ball and give it to you in a circumstance that, you know, if they believe in the film as well. And I think that that's something that's been to our benefit, certainly in clearing. There's so many songwriters just in our film. It's kind of overwhelming how many people have been involved in the music.
I read about a comical moment in your film where they played Jump Around, and, well, why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, you know, so like I said, Major Lazer is a DJ group, and so they DJ all over the world, and Jump Around by House of Pain is one of these songs that you hear in NBA games or NFL games or at any wedding, bar mitzvah, party, anywhere you go, if you play that song, people are going to go crazy. That's how it goes. But there was this incredible moment, and this happened a few times in the concert, where, you know, they're playing all these songs, and then suddenly they play that song, and everybody knows the beginning of that song, those horns in the beginning, and everyone sort of just, all the, you know, 500,000 Cuban kids kind of all just stood there. And we're like, this seems like a good song. Like, no one had ever heard it before, because the penetration of culture is just so... they're just so isolated, and particularly that era of music has just not gotten down there at all. So, you know, they hard cut into Jump Around, and everyone's expecting everyone to go completely crazy. And then they're all just sitting there kind of bobbing their heads really gently to the song. So, you know.
That's great. Frost and Steen, can you tell us a little bit about how you guys co-collaborated on the film that you made?
Well, Firas has been working on the project for a long time before I came in, and we were there was a workshop set up in Turkey. I'm from Copenhagen, Denmark, where we went to, set up by Helik, who's here in the audience, and that's where we met, basically. And the characters came over the border from Syria, and we started the collaboration from there. And we went back to Europe, and they went back to Syria, and so they upload material that we reviewed, and Firas has been working with them, basically directing from afar, and I've been kind of looking over the shoulder and giving my comments, and then the kind of tighter cooperation came when we started editing, yeah.
What drew you to the subject matter?
Sorry?
What drew you to the subject matter?
There is a really sad war going on, and of course, in Europe, the debate about refugees is everywhere, and I think it's, from the European perspective and from the American perspective, it's very important to understand what's going on in Syria, why all these people coming. And of course, also the whole strategy of the war itself, hopefully to make a film that could change, to make people witness what is going on. I think that is, you know, our prime goal.
That's
and
great.
What we hopefully done.
Thank you. I'd like to go down the panelists, and if you could, you know, starting with Laura, if you could just tell us what you're most proud about of the film that you made.
So I got a call this morning from Mary Berry, his daughter, Wendell's daughter, saying that Wendell would like to see the film. So that made my day.
That's great. Steen.
What was the question again?
The question is, what are you most proud about of the film that you made?
I think we made a film that really grasps the hearts of people, and even though it's very graphic and very rough, people still see some hope in it, that that the characters and you know they see something they can identify with in the characters and the relationships that they have. And so even though that it's a very sad story, you still come out, I think, with a feeling that, you know, humanity will prevail, or yeah, this feeling. And I'm very proud of that.
For us.
I don't know. Actually, I don't know. I'm waiting to, after like this is film end with the theater, with the like connection with the people, and I can't tell. Till now, I don't know.
So, yet to remain seen. Yeah, Austin.
I think that I'm the most proud of the way being able to light up a lot of kids in Havana who probably otherwise wouldn't have been able to get their message and get their story out. And even though some of those stories are very small and very personal, I feel very proud that we were able to do that. And I think that now it's important, you know, if everything, I think that empathy is so important. And I think that if we can make something that, you know, a lot of people who have watched our movie, they watch the concert and they see these 500,000 Cuban kids and they go, wow, that looks just like this concert I was at in Brooklyn last week. And I think that that comes as a really huge surprise to a lot of people. And what I found is that kids everywhere are basically the same. If they're in Cuba or they're in New York, they all want the same thing. They all want to listen to music and they all want to, you know, health, and they want to have fun. And I think that if we can, you know, be able to tell other people that and show other people that, and in the guise of a music documentary or a concert doc, then that's something I feel very proud of.
You know, you start making a film, and it's one thing to make the film, and then the world changes suddenly, and your film is suddenly very relevant in a very different way. So that's happened to Motherland. You know, it's a film that takes place in the Philippines. The story is very rooted in that country. But because of, you know, what happened during the election season, it's very relevant here now. So we've we are going to partner with Planned Parenthood to do a big outreach and social impact campaign around this film. I don't think that would have been in the radar before November. And now it's going to happen. So I'm really proud. I think it's going to really bring about a very substantial conversation around reproductive justice and reproductive rights and access to contraception, you know, in this country. So I'm proud about that.
It's amazing, Tom.
So I'm just curious, because hearing how all of your films are essentially real life films, and I'm more used to kind of the fiction side of the world, but my client's biggest challenge generally have been funding, right? Money. I think there's no shortage of creativity anywhere at this festival or with any of you. You know what you want to do, and rarely, or I've never had that heard of that problem, but how did you guys deal with, and we kind of heard you got lucky, right? You got a grant, or I don't know, you worked for the grant, but how did you guys, what did you do for financing? What was your kind of plan and your structure, and did you have a lawyer when you did it, or did you find a treasure chest, end of the rainbow, pot of gold? How did that happen?
Well, in the case of Motherland, it's a foundation funding. You know, Sundance, Chicken and Egg, Catapult, ITVS, POV, which is PBS, public media. It's very important, so I hope it, you know, it remains alive. That's the funding of Motherland. Did I get a lawyer? Well, yeah, I brought in a lawyer, went to do all the contracts, right? A lot of contracts going back and forth. But yeah, it's all purely foundation money. And it's not easy. It's never easy. So fiction, nonfiction, funding is never easy.
It's long journey to like to get like, I study like in Western, in France, but I'm a Syrian. So it was like, for me, it's something, it's like to need a lot of fighting to make these people trust from somebody who is coming from Syria, want to make a film. And this is the first things. And then they need to know, who are you? What's your background? Are you terrorist? Are you good man? Are you Muslims? Are you secularized? A lot of a question behind. They didn't ask like direct way. They ask it like with this is like official way. And you feel in the eyes because, and you, when you look to the eyes and you feel this is a question, it's coming like to hit you in your head, and you said, you can try. It's an experimental trip. And a lot of things could happen during like this is journey to make this is deal coming. Even you have experience in making movie, even you have a good angle like to do the movie, but it's about the trust also. It's about how you establish the trust that make the this is like the companies or funding trust in you from their point of view, like to make you like application fill, this is application in what we want. And then sign on what we want. And then we give you money. Small money, small money, small money, small money. To do the movie. And then when you do the movie, all want to share you the the winner. And the we was like looking from the first minute, from the when you say the idea, oh, this is a great idea. Did you remember when I told you that? It's in with this is way, and we said, oh, okay, yeah, you told me many things, but I'm not sure about anything that you told me about it. So this is like, and after that, I mean, in general, like when you end, like with that's make you like feel okay with everything that you make the films, and this is films goes should go to the right way, and this is other fighting. It's not just in like with this big screening and the big festival. There's other trip. You have a goal, and the company have a goal, and the broadcaster have a goal. And for me as a filmmaker, I count the film in the second. I can't delete a second from the film because it's a big fight. It's 2 years from fighting to do this movie, and then when just cut second, it's like cutting your heart because it's real things, real. It's coming from here. It's not coming from balance or, oh, you should be cool, this is a business, and this is things. No, it's for me, it's like something from inside, more than the business. So it's need a fight. I need a fight because I believe that it's the connection with the real people. When you talk to them, when they watch the movie, when they watch in their eyes, this is connection, then you say, I know. Then this is my will be the answer on your question before.
I do feel lucky, you know, to have made the film, but I don't feel like the funding was lucky because it's exactly what you said. It's like small money, small money, small money, and I think you know I was able to raise about $25,000 in donations from individuals who thought it was a good idea, and then you go and shoot, and then you edit. And then you show that to people, and you get a $10,000 grant here, and a $12,000 grant here, and a $100 donation here, and you know, and then you go shoot again. I think sometimes I talk to people who want to make films, and they kind of imagine, oh, we're going to go get the money and then go make the film. I don't know, maybe some of you had that good fortune, but it was like, that's never how it's worked to me. You know, you get a little bit, you go shoot, then you show what you have. You do the hard work, show what you have, and then people like it, and then they fund it. So I think the key is like diversifying your funding sources. Like, I have some foundation support from Sundance Documentary Fund and International Documentary Association, Austin Film Society, but then we did a Kickstarter for a very specific portion of the film. We wanted to have a prologue, and my co-director said, you know, the film's good, but we need a different beginning. So we raised $50,000 in a Kickstarter specifically for that, which was great, because you sort of build community, and you start a social media kind of campaign, and that helps. And then you find families, or you find an individual who might have access to a family foundation, because sometimes the grant money Ramona's talking about, I mean, you write a grant and 6 months later you might get a yes or a no, and so sometimes it's easier to find families who have private foundations and pool some of those resources together. But it depends on how you structure it. If it's an investment, that's a different process versus if it's something you can access the foundation money or donations for. But it's little tiny pieces, you build it together, and then over what, you know, many years you kind of finally have it funded. Or you come to Sundance and you still have a bunch of deferred salaries to pay.
But some of the smaller foundations like Catapult and Chicken and Egg, they're small enough to be nimble. So you'll get that initial grant from them, and throughout the, you know, the process of making the film, they will give you money as you need it, if you can prove you need it. Mm-hmm. So they're able to move a little quicker because they're smaller.
Well, we're sort of nearing the end, and I want to leave some time for audience questions, but I just want to thank each and every single one of you. You guys are doing some incredible work, making change in your corners of the world, and I look forward to what's ahead. I'd like to open it up for questions. Lauren.
Thank you, Madhu. Thank you for your work. I think it's very important what all of you are doing. And I just wanted to touch on one thing that you said in terms of being transparent about what the story that you want to tell. Well, what happens when you have an idea for the story that you want to tell, something happens during the filmmaking, and that story changes, and maybe the characters are reflected in a different light than you intended? You know, are there legal implications there? You know, how do you make sure that you know, you're being able to be true to the story?
Mel DeMarcos probably wasn't really happy, right, with what happened?
She was, and then she wasn't, you know, depending. She was very vulnerable to people around her who would whisper in her ear because she was like that. That she lived her life in a bubble, independent, very dependent on people who would filter things through her, you know, as all people are in power, I think. But in terms of the story changing, when I film, I never really have a story in mind. You know, I'm hoping that the story unfolds and I'm surprised by it. And I'm willing to be changed by the story as well. So I have ideas and themes in my head, but the particulars of the story depend on life unfolding in front of the lens. So wherever it takes me, I go. Which I think is, for me, as a documentary filmmaker, that's the most exciting thing. I don't want to have a set idea of how my story will end. You know, I want to be surprised, because I feel if I'm surprised, my audience will be surprised. So it hasn't really... now, of course, in the process of filming, like a previous film I did, one of my characters, or what I was filming teachers in Baltimore, and one of the... participants I was following, her husband went to prison in the middle of shooting, and she was hesitant to talk about it. I got her to talk about it, you know, and then when the film was done and I showed it to them, she had a problem with it. She goes, you know, that was one particular time of my life. I'm no longer that person. I've moved on. And so to try to explain to them that, yes, I think the audience will understand that that is a snapshot of your life. And that you know, life doesn't end when that last frame ends. So I invited her to all the Q&As because she just wanted to respond to that self that was no longer her. Yeah, so I'm not sure I answered your question, but yeah.
I think you can only be clear about your intentions, you know, and I think that everything that happens afterwards, real life and whatever magic happens, is just how things evolve. There is never, I don't think there's ever a point where, you know exactly what the story is going to be and how it's going to end, but you can be clear about what spirit you're approaching the whole project with, and hopefully they will be sympathetic to that, and hopefully they will understand that, and understand that it's something that evolves as things go on and as more things are revealed, and they'll, you know, hopefully the subject will trust you enough that the, they'll understand that the story that you want to tell and what they revealed to you is what belongs in the film.
Hi, I was just wondering if you guys have any stories or situations you've been in where the funding you've gotten for a film has been conditional on how you had to deal with it. For example, a foundation that provides money wants a very specific message or a very specific event shown a different way.
Great question.
Just do your film. I mean, fight to do it. That's what I do. I mean, we fight a lot to do what you want.
I don't think I'd ever take money from a foundation with very specific agenda. I don't know. But I don't think I would. I never have. That's never been a problem, especially with the foundations I mentioned. They really leave you alone. They give you artistic control because they want to support you, not only the film, but they want to support you as an artist, as a filmmaker. So that's never been a problem. I don't know.
Yeah, it's especially about artistic point of view. They want to shoot you in the head. What? You want to make artistic thing in the documentary? Then you will kill the documentary with the artistic. We have our experience with the fish, like in our film, there is the opening scene is a fish. Like, yeah, this is conversation about fish in opening film about the war in Syria. It's not, I'm sure, not what this idea could make and what the people will understand from the idea. And the whole idea of how you can tell the story in from artistic point of view, it's hard. Sometimes it's not easy to make the people understand what you want. Mm-hmm. Because in general, you are a filmmaker, you are coming to tell the story in artistic point of view, but the broadcaster for them, like one of this deal now, we should agree about it. If we want to broadcast our film on the big channel TV, we should cut like the fish from the as an opening right. scene. And all the artistic feeling in the film, we should cut it out. And this is like, we have to agree if we want like bigger audience, or we have to say no, then we will our film like be in the theater, and then nobody will watch it just in the theater. And this is like your dilemma. And then the... And all the time, it's with every film, with every story you start thinking about, then why I go to film school and thinking about Michelangelo and thinking about all these things, and why just like, I go like, this is life, I have my camera filming and ask some journalists who have like 30 years experience in the television as a commercial editors and ask him, this is good for you. He said, then this is footage. Just write write me as a director and edit the film as you want and make it for broadcast it for the television. I think our rule and deal, this is life as a filmmaker who thinking in the role of the art is fight to do what you want, even fight to change this system in the channel TV, in all the broadcaster, the internet broadcaster or the big broadcaster, the television broadcaster. It's big battle. In the end, maybe you win, maybe you get some step, a little bit. But don't say, okay, I sign just to broadcast my film. I need to be famous. I need to make my film for bigger audience because it's better. But and sometimes they come with this deal. This is film about your ego as an artist. You just delete the character and think about yourself because you want to build this is artistic point of view. But this is me. This is I'm art. I study art. I study film because I want to do this. I work with this idea because I want to do this. Then there is something between me and between the issue that I choose to do it. If that, then anyone who can do this.
Yes, I was going to say, like, not so much the funding, but I'm dealing with the same thing right now. So, like, you might get funding that gives you Final Cut, but then you might have a distributor who's interested in the film, and they might come at you and say, well, you need to cut, in my case, there are sensitivities, I think, among some of the, I'm not going to say any names, but, like, broadcasters who might have a very specific idea about what's politically correct. And I'm making a kind of loving portrait of white rural male tobacco farmers, you know, which is not exactly in the wheelhouse of politically correct at the moment. So they might think, okay, why aren't there any African-American farmers? Like, can you go and find some African-American farmers? I mean, I literally have had that request. We'll broadcast it if you do that. And it's like, well, Wendell Berry wrote an entire book called The Hidden Wound about racism in America, but this farmland was marginal farmland. It wasn't plantation land. You know, a lot of these farmers didn't have money to have slaves back in when we had slavery, and not every story about the rural South have to be about slavery, you know? I mean, of course, this is an atrocious part of our history, but can we talk about complexities, you know? And I think some people are just afraid. Broadcasters, distributors might be afraid of touching things that, and the reason why we're making it is because we want to tell a story that's not being told. And then the broadcasters might like it because it's at Sundance, you know, or it has Robert Redford's name attached to it, but they don't want to touch something that they can't see in their rearview mirror that someone else has already done. So it is this, sometimes it's artistic, sometimes it's political, and it is a thing you have to make a call of. Like, well, do you want this message to get out there? Will I compromise pieces of it or not? And I think it's less about, maybe at least from my experience, it's less about get the funding, but it's more about, you know, how you want to distribute it and what compromises you're willing to make.
In the case of Motherland, you know, it's going to be on POV, and there's a lot of nudity in it. It's not gratuitous. I mean, we are in a maternity hospital, so you see a lot of breastfeeding, you see a lot of breasts, and so POV wanted it, and it's going to be on public television, and they said, well, we had to vet it with PBS, and, you know, it's all, but they agreed to all the scenes, and I was very surprised and very thankful. I mean, we agreed to a card at the very beginning, at the top of the film, saying this is for mature audiences, but they didn't ask to cut any of the, you know, I mean, because it would be a different film. You can't make the film without showing, you know, some breasts, because it's a maternity hospital, for heaven's sake. So, you know, I was very surprised and very thankful that they signed off.
Well, thank you to all of you for sharing your stories and for being with us this afternoon. I think that everyone learned quite a bit. I certainly did. Thank you.